Hey everybody, this is Tom, and we are joined today by the illustrious James Tunney again, recording from my vehicle so as to improve the acoustics, which is mildly ridiculous, but it is what it is, so thank you for bearing with us in that connection. So far, in our talks, James, we sort of started with the, exploring themes of the Scientocracy, the systems of plantation, and sort of went on from there to various other corollary considerations. But in the background, insofar as awareness and all that pertains to the manner in which things like the drive toward a plantation society occur, you have the issue of thought, thoughtfulness, thinking in an engaged manner as a component to resisting oppression and in fostering a more engaged, freer life, and so on. And this, I believe, is a theme that you've taken up more explicitly of late. And maybe we can open up with that, the question of thought and thoughtfulness and thinking, and how circumstances have unfolded over the recent centuries to actually attenuate the degree to which we are thinking.
Over here it's the Feast of Santa Lucia, so that's Saint Lucia, so a happy Saint Lucia Day to you over there. So yes, thanks. It's nice to talk to you again. And in the context, or what prompted me to think about this in relation to your work, especially when you emphasize the thinking aspect in your explorations, is the fact about the end of thinking. And I'm in two ways. One, the end in the sense of what's the objective of thinking, because thinking doesn't exist in a vacuum, in a nebulous sense, as a cloud. And secondly, the deeper, more concerning issue is that literally we may be coming into a post-thinking era where literally thinking as we know it in a Western context is no more. Now, this is a thing that people don't really or haven't really considered, and they don't really believe it. They can believe that the species is going to end, but somehow they don't believe that the actual process of thinking may begin to end. And in particular, when I explore the work on posthumanism and the arguments which seek to deconstruct the nature of humanism and the nature of thinking, or the nature of the human, then thinking in a way comes into that. And it also raises issues about the difference between pragmatic thinking and ideological thinking. I always saw myself in terms of a pragmatist, in the sense of, if we go back to the US pragmatism and the early school and William James and Peirce, and the idea of looking at thinking and how what the consequences of a thought are, or consequences of a particular mode of thinking in its early stages. I found that a useful reflection of what was regarded as kind of common sense, if you like to call it that, as opposed to what for me was ideological thinking, or to other pragmatists of an early school, which meant that your decision was determined or predetermined by a set of rules applied to the situation, irrespective of the situation, so that you couldn't deviate from the ideological answer to the question. And I can see this conflict, for example, when I was teaching in China or teaching in other countries. There was, or Finland, for example, there was an utterly different assumption in relation to how you teach, what we were doing, whether you could apply the Socratic method or not, for example. It doesn't go down so well in China, because there's a different mode of thinking which comes from the ideological perspective as well. So the ideological undercurrent is impacting on a lot of what are supposedly descriptions of the technological environment. In a lot of post-humanism, there's an acceptance of the inevitability of technological change, and they purport to merely describe what's happening, whereas in many senses, they are active players in this process of transformation of society. And we can tell that by looking at the sources of grant funding, for example, from big corporations, big institutions who are involved in biotech. There's a lot of crossover with a lot of people that you might think are just engaged in philosophy. So I've come more to the conclusion that what we taught, I gave up on philosophy in some senses as an active contributing force to discourse in the last generation. So I found it strange to hear there was some people like yourself who believed in that and were applying it and were genuine about their endeavors and were doing what you're meant to do, questioning things and inquiring things and engaging in discourse. But that's not really representative of what a lot of philosophy has become. Philosophy has become, in my argument, a handmaid to major doctrines of materialism, both left and right. And in my analysis, they both serve the same purpose. They both aim to destabilize the existing society so that they can bring back or build back a new totalitarian state. Both left and right lead to that position. So in many senses, for example, people that I would have expected on the left to be criticizing big capitalist organizations, big corporations, are not doing that. They're supporting the agenda. I do find that, I mean, when I began to look at critiques of post-humanism, I did find good ones from ordinary, decent Marxists, if you like to say that, people who are logically consistent and who said, hold on a second, how can we blame all of humanity for what capitalism or communism in relation to certain iterations of it have done? That it's a class issue. We can't attribute, project, blame onto everybody. And so there are you know, people who are being consistent, who are realizing that this is not actually a left position that's being promoted. So what I argue is that, you know, what I'd like to suggest is that the consequence of our moving from informal human communications to the formalization by technology of human relations leads to a situation where our ability to engage in independent discourse is going to be limited by the medium itself and controlled by the medium in relation to what we say, what we're allowed to say, what the system will allow us to say, what the AI will allow us to say. And as associated with that will be a reduction in our ability to engage in any thought outside a straitjacket. And in my book, The Plantation of the Automatons, I argue that Bletchley Park was very significant in relation to the creation of the Empire of the Mind from 1943, and that was important for the old British Empire, which never went away, through Australia, New Zealand, Canada, etc., and America. And there was where they had the recent AI summit on safety. And also, if you look at Michael Schellenberg recently on disclosures in the United States, it's becoming clear that there are corporate bodies which come in the penumbra of the military cooperation, military industrial complex in the United States, which were managing the algorithms in relation to recent crises in the United States, that to circumvent the Constitution, that corporations have been doing this and they've been censoring things which are true. So despite all the constitutional protections, it corroborates my view that the power as we believe it is not being constitutionally adhered to. And I think this is much worse. I believe that it will happen in the United States, that the government is overthrown by contingency of government plans, that the government is supplanted in toto. The Senate, the House of Representatives, the Supreme Court will be replaced in emergency context. I believe that will happen because it has been planned for since 9/11. The overall point is that the freedom that we believe that we have has been severely undermined, and it's been undermined as well, not least from the academy, who are in their attack, supposedly for marginal groups, on the notion of humanism, are also attacking the basis of human rights and the protections which grew up over hundreds of years to protect us against the misuse of power. And I believe that the algorithms in this emerging technocratic system will forbid us from engaging in any communication, any sharing of ideas, and that will only get worse, that the censorship will only get worse. So it will come to a stage where our ability to engage in communications with others will be actually and technically restricted. So as well as that, there is a deeper issue about whether you're entitled to think. When coming from an Irish context, well, we used to get one of the gold or the silver medal, perhaps, in the oppression Olympics in relation to hundreds of years of colonialism. All of a sudden, even though I saw, and this is supported by the left literature, I saw what was gross stereotypes when I was a student about Irish people continue, and the left were very conscious of that. In a generation, and somehow I turned into an oppressor, and all the people, all the starving peasants going back for generations were actually oppressing loads of other people according to this new theory. And as a result, the implication is that I don't really have the same right to contribute or to articulate according to some people. This is getting worse. This expansion of disentitlement is growing and growing and dangerous. I suggest that this is part of a movement, a slippery slope towards the total censorship of human voice and the total eradication of human thinking. And the notion of posthumanism, the notion of the deconstruction of the human, of the special position of the human species, will remove the foundations of our right to say anything significant about the state of the world. So it's much, much worse than people realize. The censorship that we're talking about is something much deeper, much more insidious, much more anti-democratic, and it really is part of the general assault on the species itself. So I think we're actually witnessing the start of the end of thinking as a legitimate exercise. Now, people can't believe, perhaps, or might not believe that that's real, might believe that that's hyperbole, but if they see where we've come to in the last generation, for younger people, it's kind of harder to understand. The shift in consciousness created by the techno-imperial, the new techno-imperial New World Order, as H.G. Wells described it, as it is so devastating, so complete, that we really have to consider what's the purpose of thinking, how many of us are contributing toward these goals unbeknownst, how many believe that we're the voice of the oppressed, but are actually contributing towards this system, and how that system intends to silence everybody, every group in the future.
Well, there's a lot there to unpack. And I wish I was in a position where I could resist your analysis. But unfortunately, I'm broadly we're on the same page. Now you talked about various modes whereby thought is being throttled, arrested, whether it be legal and technical restrictions and so on.
Yeah,
I would add that I think in the technological context into which we find ourselves being inserted actually leads to an atrophy of our faculties, even in an organic manner, so as to render the need for explicit censorship or the use of force almost moot. And to concretize what I mean by that, vis-a-vis an example, you can look at what happens when you call like a pharmacy or something to have some issue addressed, and you have to deal with a robotic interface, and they're going to give you three options. You press 1, 2, 3, and the need that you have to have addressed will be under none of those options, right? So yes. If you look at just how, now you come back to the question of thought, what is thought? What is the end of thought? What is the end of thinking in the sense of its purposiveness? At first blush, we could say that it is a form of engaging and coming into a meaningful awareness of the real or reality. The real or reality is an open space of multifarious possibilities, which will resist being subject to an enclosure of the commons intellectually. But that is precisely what transpires with these modes of technology, is a kind of intellectual enclosure of the commons, where instead of the open field or space of reality, you are given a finite set of options, which actually sort of proffer only an illusory choice as to what's on the table. And that truncation then induces a really paralyzing myopia. And I've seen it in people firsthand. There's a tendency toward increasingly binary thought. It's A or B. We do this or we don't do that. There's no sense of range. There's no sense of the middle term or nuance. And I think that it can be tied very tightly to the manner in which, by interfacing with these technologies, you actually are compromising your own thoughtfulness, because you're training your disposition to try to see things in terms of finite sets of terms rather than being open to the whole range of what's actually possible, what's actually real. And so while it might seem hyperbole, as you say, to suggest that we are witnessing the end of thinking, I don't think it's so much of an exaggeration in light of the extent to which this culture is trying to induce a very algorithmic, if you like, relationship with cognitive process. I'll add that in some respects, another text that came to mind while you were talking was The One-Dimensional Man by Herbert Marcuse, in which he discusses actually this issue in slightly different vocabularies. I believe at that time he referred to how the thought du jour, as he was writing it in the, I want to say in the mid-60s, was that thought could be reduced to operational terms, that an effective thought is something that could be operationalized. And this maps directly onto the technologies. Now, the technologies, by the way, are second order. They're obviously significant, and they're serving this function of inducing a kind of atrophy of our capacities to engage the world. But it's even more fundamental than the technologies. It's a way of understanding who and what we are as human beings that is being foisted upon us. And that is the ultimate root of the hazard. So maybe you could pick up on that in terms of...
Yeah, certainly. Yeah. Again, I agree. And the word atrophy is a word that is very much on my mind recently. And I've used the word crystallization. It's a crystallizing, a making hard of a fluid process. And that's what it's meant to be, to crystallize, to come into the new system. Talk about cultural references. There's two actually that come to mind. One is that great intellectual work, the Smurfs, that I remember of the kids. And if I remember correctly, Gargamel was chasing the Smurfs to get their essence out, to squeeze their blue essence out, as far as I remember. I'm sure someone will correct us. But the posthumanists say, we have no essence. The system has just taken our essence, but they deny that we have one, which is quite interesting. So they're denying the thing, which I refer to as spiritual consciousness, the deeper thing that's behind all this, that all the perennial philosophy refers to, the thing which is engaging through the interface of thought that is before it. And of course, the failure to appreciate that we're this bigger thing is the base of a lot of problems, a lot of left brain reductive capacity to understand who we are. So the other cultural reference would be the glass bead game of Hermann Hesse. And I think it's kind of very relevant in relation to how we can get into a game, and that psychology, philosophy becomes a game of glass beads that nobody really understands and ultimately is not very, very useful, but we can get sucked into the game. I thought it was a very good kind of image, metaphor, motif in relation to the academia and the people who should be thinking, whose job is to think, and what they're doing or not doing to contribute towards the situation. So I agree as well that our interaction with this technology is reflexive. So we begin to adapt to, once we engage with it, and it's more powerful. It has more patience than we have, and we become its patients, but it influences our nervous system and connects our nervous system. So another important concept, of course, is about, we could talk about the termination of thinking, or the sense of a terminal, as we're talking about computer terminals. This is the system where it meets. This terminal is moving more and more into our consciousness, where it will ultimately reside. And when it moves past our executive function, our sovereignty is gone. Our ability to exercise that independence is gone. And it terminates us as humans in that sense, through that movement of the terminal, the terminus, the boundary. And this is what posthumanism is, an attack on the boundaries of the human, the denial of the boundaries of the human, as is mirrored in relation to political context. There's no boundary. There should be no boundary. It doesn't matter. Why have a boundary? Why have a frontier? All that kind of stuff. It's a deep idea that's politically useful in order to penetrate into systems that were hitherto seen to be sovereign and that had reasons to protect itself. At the same time, where we have this strange, as this kind of hygienism, as a number of thinkers are beginning to understand, that there's a deep, not just Illich, but other thinkers about, and particularly from the left, realizing that there's this focus on hygiene and supposedly of the body and in a medical context to replace the soul. It's a replacement of the soul that's there. The and you say about operations as well, and I think of opera and I think of soap opera, and soap opera is the description of the political system we're facing. And soap opera is on decline in many contexts. They're shifting away from soap opera. And the reason why they're shifting away from soap opera is because political discourse is soap opera. It's moved up. What we're facing is a situation which Aeschylus would have been familiar with, going back to early Greek drama and tragedy that Nietzsche talked about, where we are involved in a global situation where the media represents the chorus of repeating messages and signaling messages in choreographed, orchestrated, saying the same thing universally. They are the Greek chorus that are telling us. And there's a tragedy afoot, and we are the tragic figures in this. The human race is the tragic figure in this emerging thing. They have told us this. They don't like us. The system doesn't like us. There's a great deep misanthropy. There's the attack on arguments now about anthropocide, about moving from genocide to removal of the species. And 100 years ago, exactly, Churchill wrote about this, about you know, are we going to commit suicide as a species? Now, he was concerned about nuclear weapons, and that explains one of the reasons why he was so interested in creating the empire of the mind. But he was aware that there was a deep, strange misanthropy in human nature that could destroy itself. And the problems that we're facing are not coming from ETs, asteroids, external things, atmosphere, whatever. They're coming from the human psyche. The problems that will destroy us as a species are coming from within the human mind itself and our failure to engage in those issues. So the crystallization is part of a process of moving towards a zoo. It's quite clear that the zoo, the mentioned park, as philosophers in Germany talk about, is on the agenda, has been for 100 years. We're intended to live in a zoo. That's why Desmond Morris was talking about the cities being the human zoo. And that's totally consistent with ideas in Darwinianism, going back to Darwin in the zoo and thinking about the nature of humans and human habitation. And it's consistent with what they said in the 1920s when the empire was shifting. They talked about the future human zoo and the 15-minute cities we have on the way, the inability to move, but you'll be able to see us through a glass window, like on Zoom. Even the robot cars from Amazon that are called Zoo X. We'll come back to that X in a second. They're signaling to us. This is what the future is for the ones that don't want to upgrade. The ones that don't want to upgrade are, according to one of the transhumanists, the chimpanzees of the future. So we were chimpanzees in the past, coming from Ireland, and we're chimpanzees in the future. This is what they're telling us. Nothing has changed, actually, except the fact that the Irish were white chimpanzees, and white is bad now. So we're getting in a worse position, according to the scientific mentality. One of the things that's important to understand is they don't think in terms of philosophy. It's a mistake to think that they're thinking in philosophical terms. I'm meaning this, the people behind this apparatus. They've laid out their objectives in the New World Order, in H.G. Wells, The Open Conspiracy, scientific elite governing the world, using public health, biodirectorate, and doing experiments at will and with no commitment to any ethics beyond that, really, despite their superficial claims to collective rights. And you see it more clearly in Bernal, that there's no pretension towards protection of human rights, especially if they're not living here. If they've got their places on the moon by then, they won't be worried about whatever happens. It's an experimental context. But if we think about games and the Homo ludans that was talked about in the 30s, this is really, really important. If we look at Elon Musk's former girlfriend, she wrote a song about him being the greatest gamer. Does he love me more than the game? No. And gaming is critical for Elon Musk. In fact, his vision of the future, he said, is consistent with what Ian Banks said. And a lot of people said, but Ian Banks described in his novels a machine-run dystopia of tech totalitarianism. He mustn't have understood that. He did understand that. Musk understood what the system was, and that's why he constantly says that Ian Banks got it right. Now, this should be concerning, but people are not concerned because they're willing to pay attention to short-term PR jobs. But he told them. So they see it in terms of a game. And if we go back to, we talked about before, about the hotspots, whether it be in Israel or in Crimea or in Afghanistan, that was part of the great game, as it was called, going back to the mid-19th century, the great game for control between the Russian Empire and the British Empire, still going on, the exact same thing. But game is very important in their mind. So as I've described it recently, we're involved in the greatest game. What is the game for? What are they playing this game for? Now, I believe that the greatest game of all is the control of human consciousness in a total way, so that the object of the game is to secure total control of human consciousness in a kind of possessive, if you want to call it a satanic way, whatever, it doesn't matter. It's total control of human consciousness, which will end thinking certain. And that is the objective of all the geopolitical context. It's not about territory. It's not about oil. It's not about all these subsidiary things. It's to get global governance and the infrastructure so that they will be able to compel the assimilation of the human into this tech system. And you can get that from Bernal combined with H.G. Wells. So that we have to also see things in terms of games. And the problem is that a lot of people don't understand what the bigger games is. So they may be down here playing one game, which seems good in its own term, but that game may be deliberately provoked in order to satisfy a higher order value, which makes sense at the higher order. And insofar as I believe that to be the case, that to be the stated aim consistently held by the greatest military concentration we've ever had in a global sense, the Atlanticist regime as camouflaged in a more diverse context, extending around the world with all its different satellites. The objective is that is utter control. It's moved well beyond national sovereignty. And that game is important to understand, that we also have to think different. We have to understand what are the things that further their interest and what are the things that further our limited interest. We don't even understand that we're in that game yet, that there's a big game show and we're in it. There's a big magic show, a big soap opera, that we're witnessing these things. So there's an obligation on us as well to have a robust historical analysis of the totality, which is why I tried to explain to people 20 years ago of the need for a pragmatic cosmopolitan view of knowledge. But that time is well gone now, because it's becoming clear to people that their world is affected by places outside their world. And the United States is not run primarily in the United States, that it's affected by networks of interest which are not located, don't have any allegiance to the United States or any other country you want to call. Yeah.
In terms of that there are games and then there are games within the games and so on, sort of to go down that avenue a little bit, what strikes me is that there's a failure. I feel that there's a failure to appreciate that what we sort of loosely term the nation state system is on the edge of collapse, really. You sort of alluded to this development with respect to the manner in which the significance of things like borders or national sovereignty have been dramatically undermined by developments into so-called international law. But there's actually a project in the background to dismantle this nation state system and bring to bear in its stead, as you said, this, I don't know, like you hear words like global government and so forth. It doesn't seem quite adequate, because it's almost as if there's an effort to destroy the domain that we will refer to traditionally as the political. It's as if they want to depoliticize the world. Yeah. And not that that's actually possible, but the illusion of that depoliticization is actually quite possible, because then it distracts people from appreciating the extent of their own enslavement. And it's sort of ironic for me as a person coming from dramatically radical left-wing background politically to be in a position where I'm concerned with something like national sovereignty. A value which traditionally is associated with the right and conservatism and so forth, right? But the concern with something like national sovereignty is not linked to a yearning for some ill-informed manifest destiny. It's rather as a way to constrain the hunger of the imperial trajectory, and in any imperial trajectory is ultimately totalizing in its appetite. There's a better way of putting it than I just put it there, but I just sort of want to expand on that notion of how we need to come to a better relationship with the notion of the nation And this is a sticky wicket because there's an almost ineluctable tension between a commitment to the human good on the one hand and individual cultures on the other, which is what a genuine cosmopolitanism allows for, that tension. But it's undermined by various ideological commitments, and any ideology is a Procrustean table and ultimately dissolves thought or abandons thought, because thinking is inimical to the formalization which is at the heart of any ideological project. I'm just sort of building on what you said. I did have one other remark, though, just as you're talking about how traditional soap opera sort of receded and been supplanted by politics. I would add it's also been supplanted by so-called reality television, which is another sort of form of insipid conditioning. When you watch that material, you have to ask, what's going on here psychologically? Why am I watching this? Why am I allowing myself to be entertained by it and by the kinds of impulses which it is encouraging? Hold on a second. Sorry. All right. Hey, sorry about that. All right, I'm back. Sorry about that.
No problem.
Where was I? I was, when you watch that sort of material, it's actually trying to convey how you should conceive of yourself. And we're being encouraged to think that we're just a bunch of petty, awful people who behave in a petty, awful way, sort of a Lord of the Flies kind of a narrative of human being. And that's just that was just sort of something I wanted to add there to what you were saying before. That being said, I don't think that we should be completely, actually it's actually absolutely integral that we not then become completely sort of pessimistic, because we can return to the question of the real, like what are we actually? And it's there where we find a kind of salvation, because we have the capacity to put down the phone. Okay, we actually have that capacity. We have the capacity to actually think. We have the capacity to be in the real. And it comes back to the issue of what is essential to human being. Because it is essential, it is actually ineradicable. And that invincibility of our capacity to be free, loving human beings that can move beyond the strictures that the systems would impose upon us. The fact that it is ineradicable is actually what gives, I think, people in power a deep sense of anxiety, because they know they can never ultimately succeed. Now, of course, that doesn't mean we should be complacent, because we can be deceived and distracted from that reality. But I feel it's important to keep it in the background, lest we just, collapse into a kind of moribund cynicism. I don't know what you would say to that.
Yeah, well, to work backwards from there, all my work is
James, I think I
predicated.
lost your audio.
Can you hear me?
That might be me. Hold on.
Yeah, it must be.
How about now?
Can you hear me?
Now I can hear you. Sorry.
Great. No problem.
All right.
So
carry on.
Let
Sorry.
me, yeah, lest anyone's getting too depressed, just let me clarify that all my assumptions, all my arguments are based on the fact of the primacy of spiritual consciousness, of whatever way you want to articulate that. I believe that we're eternal beings. I've talked about that, written about that. That's the premise. That is where the hope for me lies. That is where the source of hope. It's the source of human potential in the totality of its range of possibilities. And ultimately, it has more available to it, more weapons, if you like, non-violent sense, more scope, more creativity. More power and compassion, and ultimately, actually, this is the source now, because we're committed to this. We have no choice of the true cosmopolitanism that we will all be citizens of the world. But there's going to be different types of citizens: the citizens that recognize and respect the inherent dignity of others are going to be different from the ones who want to take that dignity away from them, and that want that control system. So I believe that a result of this recognition of our spiritual consciousness, whether you're a Buddhist or a Christian or a Muslim, is this recognition of that deep quality in the other person that we're compelled to admit, or in Judaism, or in a non-religious sense, if you come with it, as you said before, from on other occasions, from a humanist perspective. But that deep, Fukuyama calls a factor X. I don't think it's sufficient, but it's an attempt to recognize that other element of us, the humanness, which will never be captured by machines. So that's a positive starting point. But there's a big juggernaut coming that's going to wipe us all out. So there is no point for me in saying, well, it might be that big, or we'll all survive, or it won't be that difficult, or it's smaller than it is, or maybe we're no. There is a big juggernaut coming, and we at this point, unfortunately, we're going to already be paying huge prices for what we have done and what we haven't done in our failure to manage geopolitical issues, and we've luxuriated in the idea that we can have this thing and that thing and this thing together. Now, at this stage, the plates are going to go off the spinning things. We won't be able to attend to them. You can't have everything. And we're going to pay the prices of some of these things. So, for example, I've accepted these things. So I'm not depressed about it. I've understood what's going to come. And I'm aware of that. You cannot give away the boundaries of a state and believe there's no consequences for it. Again, my family were fighting, not going through all that for a nation state. It's gone now. There never will be a nation state in the form in which they fought it for. But that's not to say that I think that's good situation that's happening. And even in the ideas of, all the Irish emigrated, and therefore you should take this emigration. So the argument is that we forced you, these powers forced you to emigrate. And because you're forced to emigrate, now the remaining people are forced to take in people that are fleeing from the wars that these people caused. It's a crazy argument, but I don't want to focus on that. When I was small, I remember helping my uncle with an election, and he won the local election. The guy that he beat was a fellow called Peter Sutherland, and that we, gone around as a local politician. And this Peter Sutherland subsequently became Irish Attorney General. He became EC competition commissioner. He became first head of the World Trade Organization, head of Goldman Sachs, chairman of British Petroleum. He went on a different path than the local politician. He was right in this globalist thing. So I've seen some of this close up. So at the end of his career, he kind of, apparently, if you believe, he was concerned about migrants. This man who never really expressed any concern for the downtrodden, all of a sudden was concerned. He went to the House of Lords and he said, the United Kingdom is too homogeneous. We need more heterogeneity in the United Kingdom. It's unbelievable. And I mean, London, Britain is very heterogeneous in many measures. The objective, and he also, and him and his ilk were involved in this, the NATO's involvement in Syria, in Libya, in all the causes of major movements of people. The reason why we have these major influence, we could add in later on Ukraine as well. The reason why we had these mass migrations of people were led by the military industrial complex. And the reason is they want to destroy any possibility of resistance to the global governance system that they are implementing. There's no good reading of this. The United States, I don't believe, is going to survive in any meaningful sense if it doesn't at this stage, because the infrastructure of control will be so impaired. The central forces will be so impaired. And the commitment to having any system of rules is disintegrating, so as far as I can see. So we get the chaos before we get the calls for order. So that's what the plan is, and it's working. It's working well. So there's no bow we can put on that to make it nice. So we're going to have to put up the consequences of believing that we can live in a society that doesn't have any commitment to any exoteric rules. All the perennial traditions say that you have to have some rules. We have to agree on something, that I don't kill you, I don't rob your stuff, and all. It's not much, you know. There's a few limitations in all the traditions. And if we can keep ourselves to those ones, you know, it gets us quite a long way. But the point is that, and you use the words allude, which refers to ludere, the game, and collude is another aspect of a game. We see it in philosophy. They talk about turns, having turns, maneuvers, as if it's a game, which it is in many senses. The great game, everything is going well for the people that said 100 years ago they were going to transform the British Empire into a new... And where did the British Empire go? Where did it go to? It changed into new forms. It changed into international bodies. It changed into universal bodies. It changed into regulatory systems. It changed into international banks. The Anglo-American system with the ex-Commonwealth, the Anglosphere, as Chomsky talks about, with its new alliances that makes it look more cosmopolitan in the shop front, so that's not related to any ethnic identity. It's related to a system of power that has been around from the Norman times. It's been around for over 1,000 years at least, and may even go back to the Roman Empire in a direct linkage of imperialism. This is the structure that's there. That structure has made it quite clear that it's going to determine the evolution of humanity. It's signaling very, very clearly that we don't want humans in the way that they existed before. It's signaling very clearly that Malthusian principles that were around in the 19th century Victorian Britain, controlling evolution, the spreading of famine, etc., they're on the way because they don't like how many people is living in. That is the vision that is in control. And the awful censorship that's happening, the tyranny in Ireland, for example, in relation to freedom of speech, it's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. And these are test cases for the extension of this system with the cultivation of fears of the far right, for example. Well, most of the right-wing parties in Europe, for example, support NATO. Even when we look at Nigel Farage, he's always been a NATO supporter. These people that are supposedly, you know, fighting for nationalism and are all support this international global governance system. So they're all in on it. So both left and right are contributing towards this. A lot of them don't understand the game they're in. A lot of them don't care. A lot of them are purely venal, and a lot of them are not very bright, really. I've seen that transformation. But the nation states have been so undermined. People do not understand. They do not understand the power of these bodies. And as we speak, the World Health Organization is talking about the network. This is a total system. That's what's called their network, that will control your body, that will control your human rights in the United States, that will sue. Now, the Constitution has been, and the Supreme Court have intervened. I used to have a lot of faith in judges to save us. It didn't happen in Ireland. It didn't happen in Britain because Tony Blair changed it. the court system for that purpose. In the United States, the Supreme Court has intervened at certain stages. For example, the recent case in relation to Harvard admission, where they said you can't use your admission procedures to discriminate against certain groups on the basis of correcting a broader societal right, for example. So they did intervene to limit the power of private companies during the time of the COVID to enforce jobs on their staff, etc. They did control. I mean, there is some examples, but the in the future you may be facing a situation where there's no Supreme Court because you notionally have some emergency, maybe perhaps created by an influx of people that you don't know about who have organized themselves in some military way and causing problems that justifies an emergency situation, contingency of government, and then total control. And then with all this movement together, throw in artificial intelligence, cyber security, which means cyber insecurity, then you have the arguments where we need to regulate this globally. And if we have to work with China, well, so be it. They don't have a problem working with China. They want the same thing, this social credit system, technotronic governance. They can work with some of these allies. They don't have to war with everybody. They can form an alliance for a while anyway to deal with something. So the situation can't be sugar-coated. That's what's happening. I'm absolutely, personally, that's my view. I mean, I've tried to argue and put the evidence for that. That's what's happening. So now I don't say that in a dispiriting way. The whole point is that here is the choice that we're faced. We're faced with the choice of vindicating our own selves, our own genius, our inherent genius that every person has, their own capacity, their own potential, their own need to work in cooperation with other people to secure a bigger goal, a cosmopolitan protection of the human species, aware of all the things that have to be done about nature and the environment. This system is coming, is not going to protect nature, animals, the environment. It's going to experiment upon them. They've been quite clear on that. So yes, it's not a counsel for despair, but if we don't do anything, if we don't recognize the issue, if we don't even recognize the game we're in, we are going to lose. That's the reality. And worse than that, if you're like me and you believe in the eternal soul, there's the possibility that you're doing a Faustian pact, that this pact has consequences, of a deeper, more perpetual nature.
Yes, I can only second your exhortations. I mean, what it's really insidious is with respect to the questions of ecological character, because the relationship to nature promulgated by these people is a relationship of domination and control. So they are not interested in a deep way in the preservation of the planet. Of course, they pay all sorts of lip service to this notion of climate change and so forth. But the scrutiny of their concrete policies indicate that if there's anything benign in them, and frankly, I don't think there is, but let's just be generous and say there's something superficially benign in these policies. Those elements are only there to sort of save the game so that over a longer term, they can establish more concrete control, tighten their grip, as it were. So if you as an individual feel a positive relationship with the planet, the answer is not going to come from listening to these vipers talk about what they think is necessary to save the planet.
No, absolutely not, no.
And I mean, it's impossible at this point, virtually impossible in my view, to exaggerate their capacity for deception. It beggars belief. The absolute poverty of received discourse as to any truth value whatsoever. That's a whole other song. It's not a whole other song and dance. It relates to what we're saying about thinking, right? But if you reduce thought and thinking to this, if you understand thinking is something which is responding and which resonates with the true,
yes,
then you see that the operationalization of those processes undercuts thought at its most fundamental level, because then you're no longer responding. Then it's just an automaton that is enacting certain procedures in a fashion which actually cuts you off from that relationship. And if we permit ourselves to continue down this line, it's not good. It's not good. So what I do appreciate is that you have provided a kind of clarion call to an appreciation that there is a severity to the impasse we're witnessing at this
yes.
moment, right?
Yeah.
That maybe part of it was that I think maybe part of, speaking personally, I was sort of left in a condition of relative numbness after the past 3.5 years, in part because I was 3.5, almost 4 years now, and I was really just astonished at the extent of capitulation before the policies and procedures that were promulgated,
yes,
in the wake of the madness is to, that's how I refer to it, right? But the use of purported upper respiratory infection of a comparatively prosaic nature to induce a global house arrest, the extent of capitulation just left me sort of just bereft. I just didn't understand how people could fold so easily. And or not everybody, not everybody folded, but many, many. And so as things have sort of re-emerged to a sort of state of quasi-normalcy, I say that very sort of
guardedly, yes.
Guardedly, right?
Yeah.
It's hard to summon the energy to realize that actually this is a signal that you need to actually organize yourself and others to create a more effective resistance than what had been present prior. Because even though it seemed like it just came out of the blue, the conditions of possibility for what transpired in 2019 forward had been established over decades. And so this disastrous situation was a consummation of developments that had been on their way. And in a way, I hate to say it, it could almost just be the first salvo if we don't sort of like wake up to the fact that it was used to establish even further conditions of possibility. So, yes, I concur with your analyses, James, and I thank you for that. So, I mean, what else would you like to say?
Yeah,
I
feel like there is another book which kind of corroborates from a U.S. perspective. It came out recently called Controligarchy, which explains in the United States the involvement of billionaires in the Good Club and through the Rockefeller University and a range of people that got together to anticipate these issues, going back to, again, early eugenicists in the United States. But of course, they don't emphasize the British connection, which I think is important. But a lot of it in a modern context explained how all this was planned. Control Oligarchy, a recent book explaining an analysis which is very similar to mine. I don't disagree with it. I just think that there's an extra dimension to it. So It's not me making this stuff up. There are other corroborations and triangulations that vindicate that this was a setup. This is all of this stuff is, and there will be much more. It's a permanent revolution. So there's a carousel moving around. So you can press the buttons and you can set off Israel now. You can set up Afghanistan. I think Kashmir might come out of the blue. Don't forget about Kashmir. Some of these coming around. The big one, 2024. Happy prediction. Cyber insecurity. Make international payments, bank payments dependent on a particular system, and then bring it down. Now, already Elon Musk is talking about blackouts. That with all this investment in energy, we're not going to have enough energy. Why is that? It's because the artificial intelligence systems need more. So it's not for the people. It's not sustainability. It's the system itself needs more energy. So all of this increase is to make itself work. This is what John Lilly talked about, a solid state entity taking over the world, which would consume all the resources. And the Promethean advocates like Ben Goetzel, they talk about, they subscribe to a doctrine of taking total control of the planet. So in the future, they'll be able to move the planet out of its orbit. It's nothing got to do with protecting nature and protecting any of that. It's an absurd delusion. Delusion, of course, ludere, again, another word. There is a. I did meet one of the seers and that was involved in the Garabandal apparitions in Spain in the 1960s, which is very, very interesting. Of course, for people that don't know about that, one of the predictions, if you like, or prophecies or reports or warnings, where that there would be an illumination of conscience that was experienced by everybody in the world. Now, this might sound daft to non-religious people, but that there would be an experience that people get a choice to make, to evaluate where they are in the world. All people. It wasn't confined to Catholics. And I would rationalize that as a collective universal near-death experience. The near-death experience has, in the last generation, parallel to the rise in technology, becoming more known about an individual and even on a group level. We have a strange prophecy that there will be something like what I call a near-death experience. There is a number of traditions which indicate that there is a choice to be made, but we will have a choice individually. Now, the state of the world, we can only do so much about. Ultimately, whatever else happens, it's still about us engaging in the world individually as moral or thinking agents. So the same motivations that motivated Socrates, for example, are still in human nature. And there are people that are willing to die for this thing called the truth, whatever it is. They believe that that's the highest value. That's not going to change. Wherever it comes from, it doesn't matter. But in all these cases, the choice is still one's own in relation to what they do, how they commit to things, how they commit to the future. That's still an individual choice. And the genuine lovers of wisdom, and wisdom is not going to be something that computers are going to reproduce, the genuine lovers of wisdom believe that there's an inherent value associated with committing to those values. And they're not going to depart from those values. And over a long period of time, that commitment will triumph. It has to do, because the other things can only work over short and medium term perspective. They can do great damage, catastrophic damage. But a lot of it is about, like the Faustian pact, do we consent to something? Do we agree to something for short-term gain at the expense of longer-term values? So in all of this, a whole range of different perspectives say that it's about maintaining that sovereignty of your own choice and vindicating your own humanity, and therefore working from there to vindicate others' humanity and to facilitate the exploration of that, the valuing of that, and not to be seduced by these pale simulacra that are presenting, these things that can never reproduce, never copy, never emulate, merely mimic aspects of calculation that are not as critical in the overall scheme of things as our capacity for the deeper values. So all that stuff is really, for me, the creation of a contrast that makes it easier to choose the better values, although it seems dark in that context. But committing yourself to that revolution of things, all the things that they've set up for us, as they have done, to move seamlessly from COVID into Ukraine, into other, you know, into the Middle East, getting ready to launch cyber insecurity, almost a banking crash, all that stuff that's coming. You can't be under any illusion like that. The last point I was going to make, the symbol X, the letter X is a critical symbol. It also means post. A post and X go together as an X post, or meaning something that happened, is in many ways a recurrent symbol through all of this. It's a kind of indicator of the system itself. So we are becoming ex-humans, I think, is part of the idea. But it goes back to Thomas Huxley and the X Club. And X, of course, is about unknown quantities. What they want to do is reduce the unknown quantity in you, so you're predictable. So we take it out and externalize it and have that unknown quantity of you known, so it can be managed. Everything, the X comes up in it again and again. It's there in the World Wide Web system, the XTML and the extensible markup language. It's there in the emerging cyber payment systems between banks and the new systems that are coming for bank corporate payments. It's there, of course, in SpaceX, in Elon Musk's X artificial intelligence. There's absolute continuity with X, of course, used to mean Christ. It was in the Greek reference. But we're moving into the end of the Christian era. We're moving into a post-Christian era, which probably happens 2,000 years after Christ in their head. And this X is a symbol in some way, consciously or unconsciously, of this post era that we're moving to. It's kind of recurrent. It's a recurrent signal. It's used even when it doesn't make sense in context as a kind of indicator. We can see it even in things like, I've talked before about Kinsey and how Kinsey was used as a basis for the idea that we could use communication technology to kind of sexualize the world in a way and take their mind off other things, which is a fair bit of evidence of that. And even the word XXX was used as a signal of the adult material in the coding system. It's a recurrent kind of badge, accidentally or intentionally, of this system, of the post system that we're moving towards in some strange ways. I've detailed it in more recent writing. But what we don't want to become is ex-humans. That's what we can't do. No matter if they're telling us that we've done it already, we're not. And we have to vindicate our humanity and not get too distant from the situation we're in, so that we're made dependent, cyber-dependent, that we can't function as humans in any normal context. Okay. That's about that. That kind of covers the main points that come up or come to mind.
I think that might be a good place to wrap it up for today, James. And I really do thank you for all your time and your generous contribution here.
It's very kind. It's always a pleasure. And again, good luck with your explorations and. If I don't see you, I won't see you before then. A happy Christmas and happy New Year. I hope you enjoy that whatever time you get, or whatever festivities you celebrate, or midwinter or whatever it is. I like midwinter, 21st of December. We have to kind of celebrate our humanness and not let it be taken away from us, whatever shape or form it appears in our own life, and to vindicate in other people. So thanks very much. I appreciate the conversation, and I look forward to the next one.
Absolutely. I'll talk to you soon, James. Yeah. Have a lovely holiday yourself.
Yeah. Same to you.
See you soon. Bye-bye. Bye.